Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. The Force Awakens was recently unveiled as the title of a movie George Lucas swore for years would never be made, Star Wars Episode VII. But unlike for the previous six installments, this time Lucas is retired, an informal advisor whose empire has been turned over to Disney. It is time for a new hope. When Lucas was a Flash Gordon mad kid and film student, it was impossible to imagine the way Star Wars would come to dominate the galaxy both on-screen and off, from merchandise and replicas to books and comics to the far reaches of the internet. In what proves to be a book of wills for Star Wars fans, author Chris Taylor traces the evolution of a one-off space opera into a lingua franca that unites fans around the world all the way to the Oval Office. The book is how Star Wars conquered the universe, the past, present, and future of a multi-billion dollar franchise. And it's my pleasure to welcome Chris Taylor to the roundtable. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Ian.
Take us back to the beginning. What do you think was George Lucas's best case scenario when he first started envisioning Star Wars?
When he first started envisioning it, well, you know, that sort of begs the question of when he first started. He said he sort of vaguely had the idea during film school, that it really started to coalesce when he pitched it to United Artists in 1971, I believe. United Artists, they turned it down eventually, and George has sort of needled the then head of UA ever since about it. But he was a Flash Gordon fan, as you say, from his youth, and he tried to get the rights to Flash Gordon, and failed, and that's where this started. The first time that we see him actually considering how much money this is going to make is when he starts to talk about, once it's funded by Fox in about 74, 75, he starts to bring up this notion that, well, it might do as well as the average Disney movie, which at the time was doing maybe 16, 17 million at the box office. And for a lot of his friends, that was crazy talk. They didn't see how this was going to be anywhere near as good as a Disney film. But even 16 million would not make back its budget when you count for marketing and all the other overhead costs. So that was his back of the envelope calculation, and it was true of everyone else on the crew of Star Wars. The quote that I really love is that of Ben Burtt, who's since become a very famous sound designer, who said that the best thing that he could imagine out of all of this was that they would get a table at next year's Star Trek convention.
You know, there's a very interesting tension in the book between the official history that's documented by Lucasfilm and what a lot of ex-employees have told you, what the drafts show. The question that comes up again and again for me is just how much of this world had he mapped out and how much was kind of made up as we went along?
Largely all of it made up as he went along. I mean, what you see in these early drafts is a tremendous ability to self-edit, to say, no, that idea isn't working. You know, let's move that over here. Let's change this character's name. Let's just switch it all around, make it new, which is something that Lucas did throughout his creative life, back to being a kid and setting up a Halloween-themed garage for the neighborhood kids. He'd just change it around every time. And he's very adept at doing that, as we saw with the special edition and the prequels. They sort of changed everything around again. This notion that that Darth Vader was always thought of as Luke's father, you know, that Darth Vader and Anakin Skywalker were the same people all along, has been thoroughly debunked. Indeed, you know, a lot of people who worked with Lucas talk about this sense that he was really kind of just always sketching it out on the back of an envelope, you know, that he always took that approach to it. Even up into the latter day, into the Clone Wars cartoons that were on the Cartoon Network, the director he was working with there, Dave Filoni, said exactly that. You know, even then, George is still sort of playing with the myth of it, playing with the story, and really being rather more free and easy than a lot of the fans are.
Another thing I learned from your book is throughout the years, he said in interviews, He's had kind of the various iterations laid out in his mind for, for years and years. But the truth is, you demonstrate he was a very tortured screenwriter at various pivotal points in the creation of Star Wars. I mean, there were times when he couldn't even, get five pages done.
Oh, gosh, yeah. And that persisted right up until Episode 3, which, confusingly enough, was the final Star Wars film up until Episode 7, because it was all out of order. But even for that, he was writing it up until the last minute. The set designers didn't know what script they were working with because it hadn't been written yet. Georgia said that he bleeds on the page. It's one of my favorite phrases of his to describe his writing process. And it's dreadful. When you look at his early stuff, he thoroughly admits that he's no good at dialogue. And the early drafts of all the Star Wars movies bear that out. And the unfortunate thing with the prequel movies is he didn't really have enough people to kind of come in and say, no, let's rewrite this. Let's rewrite that dialogue there, George. He really just sort of started to see it as a silent movie, as he said at the end, or a symphony, or a jazz riff. All these other phrases that were basically used to cover up the paucity of the dialogue. He had this terrible time writing it, and it really, was free and loose with the concepts, and just changed it around until he felt that it matched the images in his head. But that didn't mean it ever got easier. I think the easiest draft he ever did was a crucial draft of The Empire Strikes Back. And you can really sort of see the results of that on the screen.
I want to go back to something you said just a moment ago about the kind of strange numbering of the films. For people who paid attention to the prequels, the last kind of new Star Wars movie that came out was number 3. And now, in the news, we're awaiting number 7. So why is the numbering the way it is?
So, going back to this sort of free and loose way that he played with Star Wars, George had this sense that he was doing an homage to Flash Gordon, right? And he wanted to give you this notion that you just walked in to a movie house that was just screening a Flash Gordon serial the way they used to do on Saturday mornings. And, you just walked in the middle of Episode 3 or Episode 4 or Episode 5. Now, he has since said that he always intended to call the first one Episode 4. The producer, Gary Kurtz, disagrees with that. He said, we sort of played around with this idea of throwing it as somewhere in the middle, 3, 4, or 5. So, it was never that definite. But that's how it worked. In 1981, the original Star Wars was renamed Episode 4. By that time, you already had The Empire Strikes Back, which was named as Episode 5, which was very confusing to people who went to see it in 1980 because they didn't quite understand where Episodes 2 through 4 had gone, thinking that the original Star Wars was Episode 1. So that sort of set the numbering system. So he kind of painted himself into a corner in a lot of ways by naming it Episode 4. Because it meant, he got to Return of the Jedi, it was Episode 6, and very much had the sense that he was done. He was done with Star Wars, he moved on to other things. But fans kept asking him, what about Episodes 1 through 3? When are you going to make those, George? And it was this constant barrage of questions that he was hit with by just about every Star Wars fan he met in the 90s, and he finally said, look, okay, yes, I'll make them. And, then we got the prequels. We got Episodes 1 through 3, one, of course, being the infamous Phantom Menace. And we ended up with 3, Revenge of the Sith. And so now we're looping back around to the end of the story, and we're picking up 30 years after Return of the Jedi,
and
which is Episode 7.
We'll get there in a second, but I want to also talk about the nature of the Star Wars canon, because you write about the Lucasfilm employees, and it really comes down to one or two people who are in charge of keeping a database of all of the vast universe that came out of the first 3 movies. And, Star Wars was licensed into all kinds of novelizations and books and comic books. And so there's this very fascinating multi-level understanding of what's actual Star Wars and what's kind of the final word. Can you describe how that works?
Well, how it worked changed rather radically in the last year. So I'll start off by describing how it used to be. So you used to have, back in the beginning, you used to just have three-ring binders all over the place at Lucasfilm. They were the internal Bibles where they just sort of tried to keep things straight. They didn't do a particularly good job of this. You know, a lot of the early novels have contradictions in them. What they settled on around about 2000 was something called the Holocron, which hardcore Star Wars fans will know is sort of this device that Jedi's use to store information. So anyway, it was this database, SQL server, really boring looking database called the Holocron, where they had different levels of canon in it. And the top level was called the G level. Now that was, the G stood for George, and that was the movies. And it was anything that George had a direct hand in. So that included the Clone Wars TV series. And then below that, you had the books and the video games and the comics. And they were all sort of a separate level of canon. So the status of that was everything in them was true unless George decided to contradict it, which he did, several times. And then below that, you had the S-level canon. And I will let your listeners judge for themselves what the S stood for, but I'll just say that the Star Wars Holiday Special was one of those items.
Yeah, YouTube that or terrible. Don't.
So that was all done away with last year. They basically flattened out the Star Wars canon, and it was kind of a drastic operation, almost a four-limb amputation, if you will. They basically said the only thing that is canon now is the six movies and the Clone Wars TV series. That's it. Everything else got moved over to what they call legends, which is basically, it just means that, everything that happened in all the novels up until this year is just sort of, it's just a myth, It just moved over to the universe next door. And going forward, they've set up this very intriguing thing called the Lucasfilm Story Group, which basically means that every movie that we're going to see, and they've already announced five movies, every novel, every game coming out of Disney, they're all going to tie in. They're all going to go through this story group, which is going to police them, basically, and allow for these sort of interesting connections across media. So, we're going to see stuff that's in Star Wars Rebels, the new TV show, it may pop up in later movies, or it may pop up in a video game. So they've got a group of Lucasfilm's best nerds basically sitting in a room and coordinating, playing traffic cop on all this content. So it's a pretty exciting way to do it.
And that brings us up to where we are now, which is awaiting the tightly guarded details of what Episode 7, which is being directed by J.J. Abrams. George Lucas is somewhere in the deep background as an advisor, but it's a new Star Wars era. What are your expectations, and where does the universe go from where we are right now?
Well, I like to say I'm cautiously optimistic about Episode 7. J.J. Abrams is a real fan. He was there at the Avco Theater in Hollywood in 1977 on day one, I believe. And, he was always more of a Star Wars fan than he was a Star Trek fan, which kind of, annoys Star Trek fans, given that he directed two of those movies. But he's, he really seems to get it. He's been sending all these signals that, look, this movie is going to have the Millennium Falcon in it. It's going to have X-Wing fighters. It's going to have Stormtroopers. It's really going to look more like the original trilogy, like Episodes 4, 5, and 6. Than the prequel trilogy. There are going to be more real spaceship models, less CGI. It's going to be shot on film. So he's really trying to telegraph, I think, to the older audience. Look, it's safe to come back to Star Wars now. Beyond that, we have, many rumors swirling around the internet, just as we did in 1999 for The Phantom Menace. Most of those turned out to be wrong. I think we're getting a little bit better about telling truth from fiction in the rumor mill, but Even so, you know, there were a lot of people who misreported the title. The title, as we know, is The Force Awakens. But for a long time, there were a series of reports that said, no, it is The Ancient Fear that is going to be the title of Episode 7. And, of course, that was completely wrong. So, you know, take whatever you read about it on the internet with a pinch of salt and just, you know, line up in December 2015 and enjoy the heck out of it. I personally think it's going to be great.
And what's the schedule after Episode 7?
After that, the tentative schedule is one Star Wars movie every year. And the numbered episodes, although they're not actually going to use the numbering in the marketing, but, you know, episodes 8 and 9, whatever they're called, will be sort of the years in between. So they'll presumably be the odd-numbered years, and then on the even-numbered years, we will get spin-off movies. And we still don't know what they're about. I've been corresponding with Gary Witter, the screenwriter on the first spin-off movie, and on Twitter, and he keeps making mention of he still has to finish the script. So whatever it is, and there have been rumors that it's about Han Solo, that it's about Boba Fett, you know, we just don't know. And we're not going to know for quite some time. So, but they will not have any real connection to the ongoing story of the Skywalker family, which is, you know, which is the episode numbers.
You know, I mean, we're obviously both dorks for this movie series, and I don't think that's, you know, outing us at all here. But your book opens with this brilliant and kind of an amazing experience where Star Wars is being seen by some Native Americans, maybe one or two who have not seen it before or heard of it, but even they have been touched by the universe a little bit. And here we are, you know, awaiting the kind of next iteration of the movies, and very excitedly so. And I just wonder, after you've spent all this time chronicling people far and wide who have, you know, built their homemade droids, they dress up in character, they go to the conventions, and so on, what do you think makes it work?
Well, I think what really works is that it isn't just for the dorks, you know. I mean, I really tried to make this a book for everyone. You know, this is the book you can give to your grandmother to explain Star Wars to her. You know, and it's difficult because the more you get into it, the deeper you can fall down these rabbit holes of, you know, the 501st Legion, which is a global group that dresses up like stormtroopers and obsesses over being, you know, screen accurate in their costumes. But that's really just the hardcore. That's a small knot of people at the center of the fandom. And you just sort of have these concentric circles, and they go out. And the largest concentric circle is just pretty much everyone in the world. And that's what that opening chapter that you reference is about. It's about just trying to see how large is that circle. Is there anyone who, you know, a lot of people say they haven't seen Star Wars, but they know all the concepts. They know the quotes. They know the character names. Is there anyone who hasn't been touched by it? And I think that the story is just so accessible. And the myths that it represents, you know, kind of accidentally in some cases, go so deep that we're all able to enjoy it, especially because it has that wonderful sense of humor. And I do have a whole chapter on sort of all the spoofs that were made and raise the question of whether Star Wars is a comedy and whether it was spoofing itself in the first place, which I kind of think it was. And, you know, George Lucas is much more, he said he's much more of a goofy director than anyone's given him credit for. And he does have this sort of weird deadpan sense of humor. And I think that makes it work. That makes it accessible. It's kind of like the Guardians of the Galaxy movie that came out this summer was a huge hit. You know, when you take these sort of science fiction tropes and you play with them, and you have fun with them, it really, really, people really just seem to love it and they seem to enjoy it. They get it. You know, it's not like, you know, Tolkien was obviously made into a very accessible movie, but if you try and read Lord of the Rings, it can be pretty heavy going, right? It's for serious nerds only. But Star Wars sort of took the delight of being in that kind of fantasy world, and they opened it up to the point where not only is it accessible to everyone, but it's sort of practically fed to us in our cribs now. You know, It's the movie equivalent of the Beatles. Everyone just seems to know it by the age of 3 or 4. And yeah, I think it's just the right mixture and just the right accessibility.
Yeah, you could say it's quite operational. Anyway, the name of the
fully operational.
The name of the book is How Star Wars Conquered the Universe: The Past, Present, and Future of a Multi-Billion-Dollar Franchise. And we've been speaking with Chris Taylor. Chris, I so enjoyed the book and the interview, and I guess I just have to say, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.